"How happily it turned out for Kitty that Anna came," said Dolly, "and how unhappily for her." "The exact reverse," she added, struck by her thought. "Then Anna was so happy, and Kitty considered herself miserable. Now it's the exact reverse. I often think of her."
"She's not worth thinking about. A horrid, disgusting woman without a heart," said their mother, unable to forget that Kitty had not married Vronsky but Levin.
"What is the use of talking about that?" expostulated Kitty with vexation. "I don't think about it and don't want to," she said, listening to her husband coming up the balcony steps. "I don't want to think about it."
"About what don't you want to think?" he asked as he came up. No one answered, and he did not repeat the question.
"I am sorry I have intruded into your women's domain," he said, glancing round at them all with a dissatisfied air, and realizing that they had been talking of something they would not have talked of in his presence. For an instant he felt that he shared Agafya Mikhailovna's dissatisfaction that the jam was boiled without water, and with the alien Shcherbatsky influence in general. He smiled, however, and went up to Kitty.
"Well?" he asked, looking at her with the expression with which everyone addressed her nowadays.
"Quite all right," replied Kitty, with a smile. "And your affairs?"
"The wagons'll hold three times as much as peasant carts. Shall we go and fetch the children? I have ordered the trap."
"What?
Are you going to take Kitty in the trap?"
said her mother, reproachfully.
"Only at a walking pace, princess."
Levin never called the princess Maman, as sons-in-law usually do, and this displeased the princess. But though he liked and respected her very much, Levin could not address her so without violating his feeling for his dead mother.
"Come with us, Mama," said Kitty.
"I don't wish to see such unreasonable doings."
"Well, then, I'll go on foot.
Walking is good for me." And Kitty rose, went to her husband, and took his arm.
"It's good for you in moderation," said the princess.
"Well, Agafya Mikhailovna, is the jam done?" asked Levin, smiling at her and wishing to cheer her up. "Has it turned out well, the new way?"
"I suppose. We'd have thought it overdone."
"It's better so, Agafya Mikhailovna. It won't ferment, and we have no ice left in the cellar and nowhere to keep it cool," said Kitty, immediately seeing her husband's intention and addressing the old woman in the same spirit.
"On the other hand, your pickling is such that Mama says she never tasted anything like it," she added, smiling and putting the old woman's kerchief straight.
Agafya Mikhailovna looked crossly at Kitty.
"You need not comfort me, ma'am. I just look at you and him, and then I feel happy," she said.
And that disrespectful way of speaking of her master as him seemed touching to Kitty.
"Come with us and get mushrooms. You will show us the right places."
Agafya Mikhailovna smiled and shook her head as much as to say, "Though I should like to be cross with you, I can't do it."
"Please follow my advice," said the old princess. "Cover the jam with paper soaked in rum, and then it will not get mouldy, even without ice."
Chapter 3 Kitty was particularly glad of the opportunity of being alone with her husband, for she had noticed the shadow of pain that flitted over his face, which so vividly reflected all his emotions when he came on the balcony, asked what they were talking about, and received no reply. When they started on their walk in advance of the others and had passed out of sight of the house onto the hard, dusty road, strewn with rye ears and grain, she leant more heavily on his arm and pressed it. He had already forgotten that momentarily unpleasant impression, and being alone with her experienced, now that the thought of her pregnancy never left him, a feeling still novel and joyful to him of pleasure, entirely free from sensuality, at the nearness of a beloved woman. They had nothing to say to one another, but he wanted to hear the sound of her voice, which, like her look, had been changed by her pregnancy. In her voice, as in her look, there was now a certain softness and seriousness, as of a person continually intent on one beloved task.
"You're sure you won't be tired? Lean more on me," he said.
"No. I'm so glad of a chance to be alone with you. And I own that, nice as it is to have them all, I regret our winter evenings alone together."
"They were pleasant, but this is still better. Both are better," he said, pressing her hand.
"Do you know what we were talking about when you came in?"
"About the jam?"
"Yes, about jam, and then about how people propose."
"Ah," said Levin, listening more to the sound of her voice than to her words, thinking all the while about the road which now led through the wood, and avoiding places where she might take a false step.
"And about Sergei and Varenka. Did you notice? I wanted so much," she went on. "What do you think about it?" And she looked into his face.
"I don't know what to think," Levin replied with a smile.
"Sergei seems very strange to me in that regard. I told you..." "Yes, that he was in love with that girl who died."
"It happened when I was still a child. I only knew of it from what I was told. I remember him at that time. He was wonderfully charming. But since then I have observed him with women. He is amiable, and some of them please him, but I feel that for him they are simply human beings, not women."
"Yes, but now with Varenka? There seems to be something."
"Perhaps there is, but one must know him. He is a peculiar, a wonderful man. He lives only a spiritual life. He is a man of too pure and lofty a nature."
"What? Would that lower him?"
"No, but he is so used to living a purely spiritual life that he cannot reconcile himself to realities, and, after all, Varenka is a reality."
Levin had by this time become accustomed to express his thoughts boldly without troubling to put them into precise phraseology. He knew that at such loving moments as the present, his wife would understand what he meant from a mere hint, and she did understand him.
"Yes, but in her there is not so much of that reality as there is in me.
I know he would never have loved me. She is all spirit."
"Oh, no, he is very fond of you, and it is always such a pleasure to me when my people are fond of you."
"Yes, he is kind to me, but..."
"But it's not like poor Nikolai." "You would have loved one another," said Levin, finishing her sentence for her. "Why not speak of him?" he added. "Sometimes I blame myself for not doing so. It will end by my forgetting him."
"Oh, what a dreadful, what a charming man he was."
"Yes, what were we talking about?" he concluded after a pause.
"You think he can't fall in love, then?" said Kitty, putting his thoughts into her own words.
"Not exactly that he can't fall in love," Levin answered with a smile. "But he has none of that weakness which is necessary. I always envied him, and even now, when I am so happy, I still envy him."
"You envy him because he can't fall in love?"
"I envy him because he is better than I am," replied he, smiling. "He does not live for himself. His whole life is subordinated to duty, and so he can be calm and contented."
"And you?" said Kitty, with a mocking smile of loving amusement. She could not have expressed the sequence of thoughts that made her smile, but the last deduction was that her husband, in extolling his brother and depreciating himself, was not quite sincere. But she knew that this insincerity was the outcome of his affection for his brother, of a sense of shame at his own excessive happiness, and especially of that desire to improve which never left him. She loved this in him, and therefore smiled. "And you? What are you dissatisfied with?" she said with the same smile. Her disbelief in his dissatisfaction with himself was pleasant, and unconsciously he challenged her to give reasons for her disbelief.
"I am happy, but dissatisfied with myself," he answered.
"How can you be dissatisfied if you are happy?"
"I mean, how shall I put it? In my heart, I wish for nothing more, except that you shouldn't stumble."
"Oh, dear, how can you jump so?" he said, interrupting the conversation to rebuke her for making too quick a movement while stepping over a branch that lay across the path.
"But when I examine myself and compare myself with others, especially with my brother, I feel how bad I am."
"In what way?" asked she, still smiling. "Don't you do anything for others? What about your small holdings, your farming, and your book?"
"No, I feel it now more than ever. And it is your fault," he answered, pressing her arm, "that it's not the right thing. I do it, but it is superficial. If I could love all that work as I love you. But of late I have been doing it like a task set me."
"Well, then, what do you say to Papa?" asked Kitty.
"Is he bad, too, because he does nothing for the common good?"
"He? Oh, no.
But one must have your father's simplicity, clearness, and kindness, and have I got all that? I don't act, and I worry. It's you who have done it. Before you were there, and that," he said, with a glance at her figure, which she understood, "I put all my strength into my work. But now I can't, and I feel ashamed. I do it just like a task that has been set me. I pretend."
"Then would you now like to change places with Sergei Ivanich?" asked Kitty. "Would you prefer to do that public work and love that given task as he does, and nothing more?"
"Of course not," replied Levin.
"However, I am so happy that I don't understand anything. So, you think he will propose today?" he added after a pause.
"I do and I don't. But I want him to, awfully. Wait, we'll see." She stooped and picked an oxeye daisy by the roadside. "There, begin."
"He will propose, he won't," and she handed him the flower.
"He will, he won't," said Levin, pulling off the veined white petals.
"No, no," exclaimed she, watching his fingers excitedly as she seized his hand to stop him. "You've pulled off two at once."
"Well, then we won't count this tiny one," said he, picking off a short, ill-formed petal. "And here's the trap overtaking us."
"Are you tired, Kitty?"
the princess called out.
"Not at all. If so, you'd better get in if the horses are quiet and go at a walking pace."
But it was not worthwhile to drive, as they had nearly reached the place, and so they all went on foot. Chapter 4 Varenka, with the white kerchief over her black hair, surrounded by the children and good-naturedly and cheerfully busy with them, and evidently excited by the possibility of an offer of marriage from a man she liked, looked very attractive. Koznishev walked by her side and did not cease admiring her. Looking at her, he remembered all the charming things he had heard her say, and all he knew of her that was good, and he grew more and more conscious that what he felt for her was something rare, something he had felt but once before, a long, long time ago, when he was very young. His sense of pleasure at her nearness went on increasing until it reached a point where, when placing in her basket an enormous wood mushroom with a thin stem and upcurling top, he looked into her eyes, and noting the flush of joyful and frightened agitation that suffused her face, he himself became embarrassed and gave her a smile that said too much.
"If it is so, I must think it over and come to a decision.
and not let myself be carried away like a boy by the impulse of the moment, he told himself. Now I will go and gather mushrooms quite on my own account, or else my harvest will not be noticeable, said he, and went away from the skirts of the wood where they were walking about, on the short, silky grass under sparsely growing old birches, and penetrated deeper into the wood, where, among the white birch trunks, grew grey-stemmed aspens and dark hazel bushes. When he had gone some 40 paces, he stepped behind a spindle bush with pink and red earring-shaped blossoms, and paused, knowing that he could no longer be seen. Around him everything was quiet. Only the hum of flies, like that of a swarm of bees, sounded continually high up in the birch trees beneath which he stood, and occasionally the children's voices reached him. Suddenly, from the skirts of the wood not far off, he heard Varenka's contralto voice calling to Grisha, and a smile of pleasure lit up his face. Conscious of that smile, Koznishev shook his head disapprovingly at his own state, and taking out a cigar, began to light it. He was long unable to strike a match against the bark of a birch. The delicate white outer bark adhered to the phosphorus, and the light went out. At last one match did burn up, and the scented smoke of the cigar, like a broad swaying sheet definitely outlined, moved forwards and upwards over the bush under the overhanging branches of the birch tree. Watching the sheet of smoke, he went on slowly, meditating on his condition of mind. Why not? He thought. If it were just a sudden impulse or passion, if I only felt this attraction, this mutual attraction, it is mutual, but felt that it was contrary to the whole tenor of my life, and that by giving way to it I should be false to my vocation and duty. But it is nothing of the kind. The one thing I can find against it is that when I lost Marie, I told myself that I would remain true to her memory. That is the only thing I can say against my feeling. That is important, thought Koznishev, conscious nevertheless that this consideration could not have any importance for him personally, although in the eyes of others it might spoil his poetic role. But apart from that, however much I searched, I could find nothing to say against my feeling. If I had chosen by reason alone, I could find nothing better. He recalled the women and girls he had known, but try as he would, he could not recall one who united in herself to such a degree all, literally all, the qualities which he, thinking the matter over in cold blood, would desire in a wife. She had all the charm and freshness of youth, but was no longer a child, and if she loved him consciously as a woman ought to love. That was one favourable consideration. The second one was, she was not only far from worldly, but evidently felt a repulsion from the world, yet she knew the world, and had all the ways of a woman of good society without which a life companion would be unthinkable for him. The third was, she was religious, not irresponsibly religious and kind-hearted like a child, like Kitty, for instance, but her life was based on religious convictions. Even down to small details, Koznishev found in her all that he desired in a wife. She was poor and solitary so that she would not bring into her husband's house a crowd of relations and their influence as he saw Kitty doing. She would be indebted to her husband for everything, which was a thing he had always desired in his future family life. And this girl, uniting all these qualities, loved him. He was modest, but could not help being aware of this. And he loved her. One of the opposite arguments was his age. But he came of a long-lived race, he had not a single grey hair, no one thought he was 40, and he remembered that Varenka had said it was only in Russia that men of 50 considered themselves old, and that in France, A man of 50 considered himself dans la force de l'âge, while one of 40 was un jeune homme. And what was the use of counting by years, when he felt as young at heart as he had been 20 years ago? Was it not youth that he was experiencing now, when coming out again on the other side of the wood he saw, in the bright, slanting sunbeams, the graceful form of Varenka in her yellow dress and with a basket on her arm, stepping lightly past the trunk of an old birch, and when the impression of Varenka merged into one with the view that had so struck him with its beauty, the view of the field of ripening oats bathed in the slanting sunbeams, and the old forest beyond, flecked with yellow, fading away into the bluish distance. His heart leapt with joy. His feelings carried him away. He felt that the matter was decided. Varenka, who had bent to pick a mushroom, rose buoyantly and glanced round. Throwing away his cigar, Koznishev went toward her with resolute steps. Chapter 5. Mademoiselle Varenka, when very young I formed my ideal of the woman I should love and whom I should be happy to call my wife. I have lived many years, and now in you for the first time I have met what I was in search of. I love you, and offer you my hand. This was what Koznishev said to himself when he was already within 10 steps of Varenka. Kneeling and with outstretched arms defending some mushrooms from Grisha, she was calling little Masha. "Come along, little ones, there are a lot here," she cried in her delightful, mellow voice. On seeing Koznishev approaching, she did not move, yet everything told him that she felt his approach and was glad of it. "Well, have you found anything?" she asked from beneath her white kerchief, turning her handsome face toward him with a gentle smile. "Not one," said Koznishev. "And you?" She did not reply, being busy with the children who surrounded her. "There's another, near the branch," she said, pointing to a small mushroom cut across its firm pinkish crown by a dry blade of grass from beneath which it had sprung up. Varenka rose when Masha had picked the mushroom, breaking it into 2 white pieces. "It reminds me of my childhood," she added, moving away from the children with Koznishev. They went a few paces in silence. Varenka saw that he wanted to speak, and guessing the subject, she grew faint with joy and fear. They had gone far enough not to be overheard, but he still had not begun. It would have been better for Varenka to remain silent. It would have been easier after a silence to say what they wished to say than after talking about mushrooms. Yet against her will, and as if by accident, she said, "So you have not found anything? But of course, deep in the wood there are always fewer." Koznishev sighed and did not speak. He was vexed that she had spoken about mushrooms. He wished to bring her back to her first remark about her childhood, but without wishing to, after a pause, he replied to her last words. "I have only heard that the white boletti grow chiefly on the outskirts, but I can't even tell which are the white ones." A few more minutes passed. They had gone still further from the children and were quite alone. Varenka's heart beat so that she seemed to hear it, and she felt herself growing red and then pale and red again. To be the wife of a man like Koznishev after her difficult life with Madame Stahl seemed to her the height of bliss. Besides, she was almost sure she loved him, and now, in a moment, it must be decided. She was frightened. Frightened of what he might or might not say. He must make his declaration now or never. Koznishev also felt this. Everything, Varenka's look, her blush, her downcast eyes, betrayed painful expectation. He saw it and was sorry for her. He even felt that to say nothing now would be to offend her. His mind went rapidly over all the arguments in favour of his decision. He repeated to himself the words with which he had intended to propose. But instead of those words, some unexpected thought caused him to say, "What difference is there between the white Boletti and the birch tree variety?" Varenka's lips trembled with emotion when she replied, "There is hardly any difference in the tops, but only in the stems." And as soon as those words were spoken, both he and she understood that all was over, and that what ought to have been said would not be said, and their excitement, having reached its climax, began to subside. The stem of the birch tree, Boletus, reminds one of a dark man's beard, 2 days old, remarked Koznishev calmly. "Yes, that's true," answered Varenka with a smile, and involuntarily the direction of their stroll changed. They began to return to the children. Varenka felt pained and ashamed, but at the same time she experienced a sense of relief. Koznishev, when he got home and went again over all his reasons, came to the conclusion that at first he had judged wrongly. He could not be unfaithful to Marie's memory.
"Gently, gently, children!" shouted Levin, almost angrily, stepping in front of his wife to shield her when the crowd of children came rushing at them with shrieks of delight. Behind the children, Koznishev and Varenka came out of the wood. Kitty had no need to question Varenka. From the calm and rather shame-faced look on both faces, she knew that her plan had not been realized.
"Well?" inquired her husband on their way home.
"Won't bite," answered Kitty with a smile and manner of speaking like her father, which Levin often observed in her with pleasure.
"Won't bite? How do you mean?"
"Like this," she said, taking her husband's hand, raising it to her mouth and slightly touching it with her closed lips, as one kisses the bishop's hand.
"Who won't bite?"
said he, laughing. "Neither. And it should have been like this."
"Mind, here are some peasants coming."
They didn't see. Chapter 6. During the children's tea, the grown-ups sat on the balcony and talked as if nothing had happened, though they all, especially Koznishev and Varenka, knew very well that something had happened, which, though negative, was highly important. They both experienced what is felt by a pupil who has failed in an examination and has to remain in the same class or be finally expelled from the school. Everyone talked with peculiar animation about extraneous topics. Levin and Kitty felt particularly happy and in love with one another that evening. Their happiness in their love involved an unpleasant reflection on those who desired but had failed to secure the same happiness and made them feel ashamed.
"Take my word for it, Alexander won't come," said the old princess.
They were expecting Oblonsky by the evening train, and the old prince had written that he would perhaps accompany him.
"And I know why," continued the princess. "He says young married folk should be left to themselves for a while."
"Yes, Papa has really abandoned us," said Kitty. "We have not seen him. And are we young married folk? Why, we are such old ones now."
"Only, if he doesn't come, I too shall say goodbye to you children," said the princess with a sorrowful sigh.
"Oh, what an idea, Mama," rejoined both her daughters. "Just consider him. Why, at present—"
And suddenly the old princess's voice unexpectedly quavered. Her daughters said no more and glanced at one another. "Mama always finds something sad," this glance seemed to say. They did not know that, pleasant as it was for her to stay with her daughter, and necessary as she felt herself to be there, she suffered keenly, both on her own and on her husband's account, since they gave their last and favourite daughter in marriage and the family nest was left empty. "What is it, Agafya Mikhailovna?" Kitty asked suddenly, when the old woman stopped in front of her with a look of mystery and importance.
"How about supper?"
"Oh, that's just right," said Dolly. "You go and give your orders, and I will hear Grisha, his lesson. He hasn't done anything today."
"That's a rebuke for me. No, Dolly, I will go," said Levin, jumping up.
Grisha, who had entered a high school, had some homework to prepare during the summer holidays. While still in Moscow, Dolly had begun learning Latin with him, and on coming to the Levins, made it a rule to go over with him at least once a day the most difficult lessons, Latin and arithmetic. Levin offered to replace her, but having once heard Levin giving the lesson and noticing that he was not doing it the same way as the master who had coached the boy in Moscow, she, though embarrassed and anxious not to offend Levin, told him resolutely that the textbook must be followed in the master's way and that she would rather give the lessons herself. Levin was vexed with Oblonsky for carelessly leaving it to the boy's mother to look after his lessons, which she did not understand, instead of doing it himself, and he was vexed with the masters also for teaching the children so badly. But he promised his sister-in-law to give the lessons in the way she wished. So he went on teaching Grisha, not in his own way, but according to the book, and therefore did it half-heartedly, and often missed a lesson. So it had happened that day. "No, I will go, Dolly. You stay here," he said. "We shall do it all properly, by the book. Only when Stiva comes, we shall go shooting, and then I shall miss the lessons." And Levin went off to find Grisha. Varenka spoke in the same way to Kitty. Even in the Levin's well-ordered household, she found ways to be of use. "I will see about supper," she said, "and you stay here." And she rose to accompany Agafya Mikhailovna.
"Yes, do. I expect they could not get any chickens, but there are our own," answered Kitty.
"Agafya Mikhailovna and I will arrange it." And Varenka went out with the old woman.
"What a nice girl," said the princess.
"Not nice, Mama, but so charming that there is no one else like her."
"So you are expecting Stepan Arkadyevich tonight?" asked Koznishev, evidently disinclined to join in a conversation about Varenka. "It would be hard to find two brothers-in-law more unlike," he went on with his subtle smile. "The one always on the move, living always in society like a fish in water. The other, our Constantine here, lively, quick, sensitive to everything. But as soon as he appears in society, either shutting up altogether or floundering about absurdly like a fish on dry land."
"Yes, he is very thoughtless," said the princess to Koznishev. "I was just going to ask you to tell him that it is impossible for her," she indicated Kitty, "to remain here, and that she must certainly come to Moscow. He says, get a doctor to come out here."
"Mama, he will do all that's necessary and will agree to everything," interpolated Kitty, annoyed with her mother for asking Koznishev's opinion on such a matter.
In the midst of their conversation, they heard the snorting of horses and the scraping of wheels on the gravel of the avenue. Dolly had not had time to rise to go to meet her husband before Levin had jumped out of the window of the room below where he had been teaching Grisha and had lifted the boy out, too.
"It's Stiva!" shouted Levin from under the balcony. "We finished, Dolly! Don't worry!" he added, running like a boy to meet the carriage.
"Is ea id ages ages ages?"
shouted Grisha, hopping down the avenue.
"And someone with him! It must be Papa!"
shouted Levin, who had stopped at the bend of the avenue.
"Kitty, don't come down those steep steps! Go round!"
But Levin was mistaken in supposing that one of the men in the calèche was the old prince. When he came nearer, he saw, sitting beside Oblonsky, a stout, handsome young man wearing a Scotch bonnet with long ribbons streaming behind. It was Vasenka Veslovsky, a second cousin of the Shcherbatskys, a brilliant Petersburg-Moscow young man. "A most splendid fellow and a passionate sportsman," as Oblonsky said when he introduced him. Not at all dismayed by the disappointment he caused by appearing instead of the old prince, Veslovsky gaily greeted Levin, reminding him that they had met before, and lifting Grisha, he caught him up into the vehicle over the pointer Oblonsky had brought with him. Levin did not get in, but followed the calèche. He was rather vexed that the old prince, whom he liked more and more the better he knew him, had not come, and vexed because this Vasenka Veslovsky, a quite superfluous stranger, had come. Veslovsky seemed to him still more alien and superfluous when they arrived at the porch, at which the whole animated group of grown-ups and children had gathered, and he saw Vasenka Veslovsky kissing Kitty's hand with a particularly tender and gallant air.
"We, your wife and I, are cousins and old acquaintances," said Vasenka Veslovsky,
once again giving Levin's hand a very, very hard squeeze.
"Well, is there any game?"
asked Oblonsky of Levin, scarcely giving himself time to say a word of greeting to everybody.
"He and I have the cruelest intentions."
"Why, Mama?"
"They have not been in Moscow since then. Here, Tanya, that's for you. Please, get it out of the calèche, behind there,"
he was saying to those about him.
"How much refreshed you are looking, Dolly dear,"
he went on, kissing his wife's hand again, and holding it in his own while he patted it with the other hand. Levin, who but a few moments before had been in the brightest of spirits, was now looking dismally at everyone, dissatisfied with everything. "Whom was he kissing yesterday with those same lips?" he thought as he looked at Oblonsky, caressing his wife. He looked at Dolly and was not pleased with her either.
"Of course she does not believe in his love. Then why is she so pleased?" "Disgusting," thought he.
He looked at the princess, who, a few moments before, had seemed so nice, and did not like the way she welcomed that beribboned Vasenka, as if to her own house. Even Koznishev, who had also come out of the porch, displeased Levin by the feigned friendliness with which he greeted Oblonsky, whom, as Levin knew, he neither liked nor respected.
And Varenka, too, seemed disgusting because of the manner in which she with her son Nitush heir made that gentleman's acquaintance, while all her thought was how to get married.
But most repugnant of all was Kitty,
for the way she fell in with the gay tone of that gentleman, who appeared to consider his arrival in the country a regular festival for everybody, and particularly objectionable was the smile with which she responded to his smiles. Talking noisily, they all went into the house, but as soon as all were seated, Levin turned and left the room.
Kitty noticed that something was wrong with her husband. She tried to seize an opportune moment to speak to him alone, but he hurried away from her, saying that he must go to the office. It was long since the farm work had seemed so important to him as it did that evening.
"For them it is always a holiday," he thought.
"Yet here we have work that is no holiday task, which cannot be put off, and without which life is impossible."
Chapter 7 Levin did not return until they called him to supper. On the stairs stood Kitty and Agafya Mikhailovna deliberating what wines to serve.
"But why all this fuss? We'll serve the same as usual."
"No, Stiva does not drink it. Kostya, wait a moment, what's the matter with you?"
said Kitty, hurrying after him. But, without waiting for her, he went away pitilessly with big strides to the dining room, where he immediately joined in the general animated conversation which was kept going by Vasenka Veslovsky and Oblonsky.
"Well then, shall we go shooting tomorrow?"
Oblonsky inquired.
"Yes, do let's go,"
cried Veslovsky, changing from one chair to another, and sitting sideways with one of his fat legs doubled under him.
"I shall be very pleased. Let's go." "And have you had any shooting this year?"
Levin asked, gazing intently at this leg, but with that pretended politeness of his which Kitty knew so well, and which suited him so ill.
"I don't know whether we shall get any snipe, but there are plenty of woodcock, only one must go early. Will it tire you? Aren't you tired, Stiva?"
"I? Tired? I've never been tired yet. Let's not go to bed at all. Let's go for a walk." "Yes, really. Don't let us go to bed. Delightful,"
chimed in Veslovsky.
"Oh, we are quite convinced that you can do without sleep and deprive others of theirs," said Dolly, with that scarcely perceptible irony with which she now generally addressed her husband. "I think it's already time. I'm going. I don't take supper." "Oh, no, stay here, Dolly dear," said Oblonsky, stepping across to her side of the long supper table. "I have much more to tell you." "I don't expect you have any news." "Do you know, Veslovsky has been to see Anna, and he is going there again. You know, it's only some 70 versts off. I shall certainly go over. Veslovsky, come here." Vasenka came over to the ladies and took a seat beside Kitty. "Oh, do tell me. You have been to see her? How is she?" asked Dolly. Lievin remained at the other end of the table, and while not ceasing to talk with the princess and Varenka, saw that Oblonsky, Dolly, Kitty, and Veslovsky were carrying on an animated and mysterious conversation. Moreover, he saw his wife had an expression of serious feeling as she gazed attentively at Vasenka's handsome face while he was vivaciously narrating something.
"It's very nice at their place," Vasenka was saying, talking of Vronsky and Anna. "Of course, I do not take it upon myself to judge, but in their house one feels oneself to be in a family."
"What do they mean to do?"
"I believe they mean to go to Moscow for the winter." "How nice it would be for us to meet there. When are you going, Stepan Arkadyevich?" asked Vasenka.
"I shall spend July with them."
"And will you go?"
Oblonsky asked his wife.
"I have long wanted to go, and certainly shall go," replied Dolly. "I know her, and am sorry for her. She's a splendid woman. I shall go alone when you're away, and won't inconvenience anyone. It will even be better without you."
"That's all right," replied he.
"And you, Kitty?"
"I?
Why should I go?" said Kitty, flushing deeply and glancing round at her husband.
"Are you acquainted with Anna Arkadyevna?" Veslovsky asked her. "She is very attractive."
"Yes," said Kitty, with a still deeper blush, and she rose and went to her husband.
"So you are off shooting tomorrow?" she asked.
Lievin's jealousy during those few minutes had gone far, especially after the blush that had suffused her face when speaking to Veslovsky. Now, as he listened to her question, he interpreted it in his own way. Strange as it seemed to him when he remembered it later, it now appeared clear to him that she asked whether he was going shooting only because she wanted to know whether he would give that pleasure to Vasenka Veslovsky, with whom he fancied she was already in love.
"Yes, I am going," he answered in an unnatural voice that was disagreeable to himself.
"No, wait a day, because Dolly has seen nothing of her husband. You could go the day after tomorrow," said she.
Lievin now interpreted her words thus.
"Do not part me from him.
Your going does not matter to me, but do let me enjoy the society of this charming young man."
"Oh, if you wish it, we will stay at home tomorrow," replied Lievin with particular amiability.
Meanwhile, Vasenka, without the least suspicion of the sufferings his presence was causing, rose from the table after Kitty and followed her, smiling pleasantly. Lievin saw that smile. He grew pale, and for a moment could hardly breathe.
"How dare he look like that at my wife?" he thought, boiling with rage.
"Tomorrow, then? Oh, please, let's go,"
said Vasenka, sitting down, and once more doubling his leg under him, as his habit was. Lievin's jealousy rose still higher. Already he fancied himself a deceived husband, necessary to his wife and her lover, only to provide them with the comforts of life and with pleasures. But nevertheless, he asked Vasenka in an amiable and hospitable manner about his shooting, his gun, his boots, and agreed to go shooting next day. Happily for Lievin, the old princess put a stop to his sufferings by herself getting up and advising Kitty to go to bed. But he did not escape a fresh pang. Taking leave of his hostess, Vasenka again wanted to kiss her hand, but Kitty, blushing, drew away her hand and said with naive rudeness, for which she was afterwards reprimanded by her mother, "That's not customary in our house." In Lievin's eyes, Kitty was to blame for having laid herself open to such behaviour, and still more to blame for so awkwardly showing that it displeased her.
"What's the good of going to sleep, eh?"
said Oblonsky, who, after the few glasses he had drunk at supper, was in his pleasantest and most poetic mood.
"Look, Kitty," he went on, pointing to the moon rising behind the lime trees. "How lovely! Veslovsky, now's the time for a serenade. Do you know, he has a fine voice. We have been rehearsing on the way. He has brought some beautiful songs, two new ones. He ought to sing them with Mademoiselle Varenka."
After the rest had separated for the night, Oblonsky long walked in the avenue with Veslovsky, and their voices could be heard practicing a new song. Lievin sat listening to them and frowning in an easy chair in his wife's bedroom, meeting her inquiries as to what was the matter with stubborn silence. But when at length she asked with a timid smile, "Aren't you displeased about something connected with Veslovsky?" he gave vent to his feelings and told her everything. He himself was offended by what he was saying, and this still further irritated him. He stood before her, his eyes glittering terribly under his frowning brows, and pressed his powerful arms to his breast, as if trying with all his might to restrain himself. The expression of his face would have been hard and even cruel, but for a look of suffering which touched her. His jaw trembled and his voice faltered. "Understand that I am not jealous. That is a vile word. I cannot be jealous, nor believe that... I cannot say what I feel, but it is dreadful. I am not jealous, but I am offended and humiliated that anyone dares look at you with such eyes."
"What eyes?" said Kitty, trying to remember as honestly as she could all the words and gestures of the evening and all their shades of meaning. In the depth of her soul, she was conscious that there had been something just at the moment when Veslovsky had followed her to the other end of the table, but she dared not own this, even to herself, much less make up her mind to tell him and so increase his pain.
"And what attraction can there be about me as I am?"
"Ah," he exclaimed, seizing his head in his hands, "you had better not say anything. So, if you were attractive..."
"Oh, no, Kostya. Wait! Listen!" she implored with a look of pained commiseration. "What can you be thinking of, since men do not exist for me? They don't! They don't! Well then, would you like me not to see anybody?" For the first moment, his jealousy had offended her. She was annoyed that the least relaxation, even the most innocent, was forbidden her. But now she would gladly have sacrificed not merely trifles like that, but anything, to free him from the torments he was suffering.
"Try and understand the horror and absurdity of my position," he continued in a despairing whisper. "He is in my house, and, strictly speaking, he has done nothing improper except by his free and easy manner and doubling up his legs. He considers it to be in the best form, and therefore I have to be polite to him."
"Come, Kostya, you are exaggerating," remonstrated Kitty. At the bottom of her heart, pleased by the force of love for her which was now expressing itself in his jealousy.
"The worst of it all is that you are as you always are. And now, when you are my holy of holies and... we are so happy, so specially happy. Suddenly this good-for-nothing comes along. You know, not good-for-nothing. Why am I abusing him? He does not concern me, but..."
"Ah, happiness. Mine and yours.
Why?"
"Do you know, I see how it happened," Kitty began.
"How? How?"
"I noticed your look while we were talking at supper."
Yes, yes.
said he in a frightened tone. She told him what they had been talking about, and while she spoke, she was breathless with excitement. Levin paused, and then, after scrutinizing her pale, frightened features, suddenly clapped his hands to his head.
Kate, I have been tormenting you. My darling, forgive me.
It was madness. Kate, it is all my fault. How could I torture myself like that about such nonsense?
Oh, no, I'm sorry for you.
For me? Me? Because I'm a madman? But why should I make you wretched? It is dreadful to think that a mere stranger can destroy our bliss.
Of course. And that is what offends me.
Well, then, I will keep him here all the summer on purpose. I will lavish attentions on him,
said Levin, kissing her hands.
You'll see. Tomorrow. Oh, but we are going out tomorrow.
Chapter 8. Next day, before the ladies were up, the vehicles, a cart and a small trap, stood at the porch waiting for the sportsmen. And Laska, having long ago made out that they were going shooting, after yelping and jumping about to her heart's content, was sitting in the cart beside the coachman, regarding the doorway whence the sportsmen had not yet emerged, with excitement and with disapproval of the delay. The first to appear was Vasenka Veslovsky in new boots reaching halfway up his fat thighs, his green blouse girdled with a new cartridge belt smelling of leather, and on his head the Scotch bonnet with the ribbons. He carried a new English gun without a sling. Laska jumped down to him and greeted him by leaping about. In her own way, she asked him how soon the others would come out, but, receiving no reply, she returned to her post of expectancy and again sat motionless with her head turned sideways and one ear pricked up. At length the door opened noisily, and out bounded, spinning round and round in the air, Krak, Oblonsky's yellow-spotted pointer, followed by Oblonsky himself, with a gun in his hand and a cigar in his mouth.
"Quiet! Quiet, Krak!" he said affectionately to the dog, which was throwing its paws up against his stomach and chest and getting them entangled in his game bag.
Oblonsky was wearing raw hide shoes, bands of linen wound round his feet instead of socks, a pair of tattered trousers, and a short coat. On his head were the ruins of some sort of hat, but his gun was of a new type, as neat as a toy, and his game bag and cartridge belt, though much worn, were of the best quality. Vasenka had been ignorant that the stylishness of a real sportsman consists in being dressed in rags, but having one's shooting implements of the very best quality. He realized it now that he saw Oblonsky in his rags, yet shining with his elegant, well-nurtured, cheerful and gentlemanly figure, and resolved to follow his example next time.
"Well, and where is our host?"
he inquired.
"He has a young wife," answered Oblonsky with a smile. "Yes, and such a charming one."
"He was ready dressed. I expect he's run back to her." Oblonsky was right in this surmise. Levin had run back to ask his wife once more whether she had forgiven him his foolishness of the previous day, and also to entreat her, for heaven's sake, to take care of herself, and especially to keep further away from the children who at any moment might collide with her. Then he had to obtain a repeated assurance that she was not angry with him for going away for 2 days, and also to beg her to be sure next day to send a man on horseback with a note, only a word or two, that he might know that all was well with her. It was always painful for Kitty to part from her husband for 2 days, but seeing his animated figure, which seemed particularly large and powerful in high shooting boots and white blouse, and the radiant exhilaration of the sportsman in him, incomprehensible to her, she forgot her own pain in his gladness and parted from him cheerfully.
"Sorry, gentlemen,"
he said, running out onto the porch. "Is the lunch put in? Why is the roan on the right? Oh, well, never mind.
Laska, be quiet. Go and lie down.
Let them out with the flock, he said, turning to the herdsman, who was waiting for orders about some young sheep. Sorry, there's another rascal coming.
Lievin jumped down from the cart where he had already seated himself to meet the carpenter who was approaching with a satsen measure in his hand.
There, you see, you did not come to the office last night, and now you are detaining me.
Well, what is it?
Won't you have one more turning made? 3 more steps will be enough, then we'll get it exact. It'll be much more comfortable.
You should have obeyed me, said Lievin with vexation. I told you to set up the string boards first, and then to make the grooves. You can't alter it now. Do as I tell you and make a new one.
The facts of the matter were that in the new wing that was being built, the carpenter had spoilt the staircase, having made it without calculating the elevation, so that when it was put in position, all the steps sloped. Now he wanted to use that staircase, adding 3 steps to it.
It will be much better so.
But where will it reach to with 3 additional steps?
Excuse me, sir, said the carpenter, smiling contemptuously. It will reach to the exact spot. It will just stretch from the bottom, you see, he went on with a persuasive gesture, and go up and up till it gets there.
Why, but 3 steps will add to its length as well.
Where will it get to?
It will go up from the bottom, I mean, and reach to the top, the carpenter repeated obstinately and persuasively. It will reach up to the wall and halfway to the ceiling.
Oh, no, excuse me. You see, it will start from the bottom and go up and just reach.
Lievin pulled out his ramrod and drew the staircase in the dust.
There. You see?
As you please, said the carpenter, his eyes suddenly brightening. Evidently he had at last understood.
Seems we'll have to make another.
Well then, do as I told you,
Lievin shouted as he climbed into the cart.
Drive on! Hold the dogs, Philip!
Having left the cares of home and estate behind him, Lievin experienced such a strong sense of the joy of life and anticipation that he felt disinclined to talk. Besides, he experienced that feeling of concentrated excitement which every sportsman knows when approaching the scene of action. If his mind was occupied with anything now, it was only with questions. Whether they would find anything in the Kolpensky marsh, how Laska would compare with Krak, and how he would shoot today. If only I don't disgrace myself before that stranger. If only Oblonsky's shooting does not beat mine, was his thought.
Oblonsky shared these feelings and was likewise not talkative. Vasenska Veslovsky alone chattered incessantly and merrily. Now, as he listened to him, Lievin felt ashamed of his injustice toward him the day before. Vasenka was really a good sort, simple, kind-hearted, and very jolly. Had Lievin come across him when still a bachelor, they would have become intimate. Lievin did not quite like his holiday outlook on life, and a sort of free and easy stylishness about him. He seemed to lay claim to a lofty and unquestionable importance, because he had long nails, a Scotch bonnet, and everything else in keeping. But one could forgive him this for the sake of his good nature and breeding. He attracted Lievin by his good education, his splendid accent in French and English, and by the fact that he belonged to Lievin's own class. Vasenka greatly admired the Don Step horse attached on the left. He went into raptures over it.
How delightful it must be to gallop across the steppes on a step horse, eh? Don't you think so? He said.
He seemed to picture a gallop on a step horse as something wild and poetical. Nothing came of it, but his naivete in connection with his good looks, sweet smile, and graceful movements was very attractive. Whether it was that Veslovsky's nature was congenial to him, or that, to expiate his sin of yesterday, he tried to see only what was good in him, Lievin liked Veslovsky's company. When they had gone about 3 versts, Veslovsky suddenly missed his cigars and pocketbook, and did not know whether he had lost them or left them on his table. He had 370 rubles in the pocketbook, and therefore the matter could not be ignored.
"Do you know, Lievin, I will gallop home on this Don side horse. That will be grand, eh?"
he said, preparing to get out.
"No, why?" replied Lievin,
conjecturing that Veslovsky must weigh not less than 15 stone. I will send the coachman. So the coachman rode back on the side horse, and Levin drove the other two himself. Chapter 9.